It's time for the one show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness of new technologies, past the frontier of what you thought was possible. It's the Pilgrim on the 405 with your host, international sales trainer, Will Crist.
Well, welcome to Pilgrim Talks on this wonderful day here in Laguna Beach, California. We're going to be talking today a little bit about organizations and how organizations can best be energized, directed, and nurtured. We have with us a wonderful fellow who's a guru in Orange County. Norman Wolf is a consultant and an author, and he's been a chief executive officer, corporate director, advisor to CEOs throughout his corporate career. He's successfully guided corporations through major transitions, leading to substantial growth, market expansion, and enhanced financial performance. Currently, he is the chairman and CEO of Quantum Leaders, a leading-edge consulting company here in Orange County, guiding boards and CEOs to improve strategy execution. He's recently authored a book called The Living Organization, and we want to spend some time talking about that. So, welcome to Pilgrim Talks, Norman.
Thank you, Will. It's nice to be here with you.
Super. So tell us a little bit about this notion of the living organization.
Well, I, as you mentioned, I've worked with a lot of CEOs and a lot of boards of directors and executives and corporations over the years. And the one question that always puzzled me is, why aren't they as successful as they want to be? Especially in the area of, we do a lot of strategy planning, and we come up with these wonderful ideas. And we all know it's much more difficult to execute than it is to develop the strategy. I kept asking the question, with such brilliant minds leading organizations and such wonderful strategies developed, why aren't they more successful? What keeps getting in the way? And after years and years of investigating that and reading and trying different things, I came to realize that there's a fundamental difference in the very paradigm by which we operate is actually the very thing that is causing us to be less effective and less successful than we want to be. And specifically, well, it's the notion that we look at organizations as machines. And what I mean by that is it goes back to the days of Frederick Taylor and scientific management. And in the early 1900s, we viewed the organization much like we viewed the rest of life. Newtonian, if I can figure out the clock, I can understand the universe kind of concept. And we apply the same principles to how we run an organization. Let me give you a couple of examples of what I mean by a machine paradigm and to differentiate it from a living organization. In a machine, we look at a machine as a system of discrete components. We put the parts and pieces together. We look at the way the manufacturing line operates. We connect the manufacturing to sales and so forth, and they're discrete components. Now, the way we often experience that, for example, is silos. Every discrete component runs in and of itself. A living organization, however, recognizes that the various parts are really an organic, interdependent set of relationships. So the best way to understand a living organization is to think of the human body. The human body has a heart, lungs, liver, brain cells, and all of that. But nobody ever looks at one as more important than the other, or looks at it as anything other than an interdependent collection of living entities working cooperatively together. If we ran the human body like we ran an organization, we'd be in trouble. As a matter of fact, for years, the medicine community tried to do that, and we're recognizing today that the health of a human body is really oriented around much more than just the physiology of it, much more than just a machine of it. So it's the same thing with an organization, and that's the fundamental concept behind the living organization, to begin to shift the paradigm away from looking at it as a machine and more towards looking at it as a living, organic entity.
Well, tell us what that would mean. What would that mean in terms of execution or in terms of management? How would we shift from seeing it as an a machine to seeing it as a living organism?
Let's take a couple of examples that I've run into recently with some clients. Let's look at the way managers lead, or the way the board looks at how a CEO leads an organization. Fundamentally, we look at it from the point of view that the CEO is the master operator of the machine. We expect the CEO to pull the levers, push the buttons, and set the right tone, the right frequency, establish the right goals and objectives, set up the right metrics, and then the machine is just going to perform. Well, we know that doesn't happen. We know that the machine is much more like a living organic. Let me use this example. From a machine point of view, every New Year's, which is coming up in a few months, people make New Year's resolutions. We look at and the success of that is the head makes a decision and the body does what the body wants, right? It doesn't usually follow through with what the head says it wants to do. That's how we typically think of an organization. The CEO and the executive team goes off and does the strategy, and we expect that the corporate body will follow suit, do what it's told. But it doesn't. Right? So the question is then, how do you actually get the organism to respond? And it really has a lot more to do with engaging the cellular structure of the body into the goals of the desired outcome. So instead of looking at it as a machine where you're pushing buttons and pulling levers, you look at it as a set of people for which you want to engage them. So now you're looking at the organization as something you wanted to develop, something you want to align and get engaged with the intent and the strategy of the organization. So that begins to shift the way leaders look at it. Now, to give leadership a set of tools, I created a model. I call it the Living Organization Model. And it looks at the organization as a flow of energy rather than a set of discrete components that you're pushing and shoving and manipulating. So instead of looking at it as a set of machine parts, you're looking at it as a organic flow of energy.
All right. So what does a manager do differently in the metaphor of the living organization versus the one where he's treating the organization as a machine? What sorts of things on a daily basis does that manager do differently?
Well, so the way to understand that is to understand what I call the three fields of energy that's flowing through the organization: activity, relationship, and context. Activity is what we do and how we do it. That's the machine part of it. That's still important. We still have to worry about it, but from a different point of view. Relationship and context, especially context, is where everything in a living organism begins to flow from. It's the energy of meaning and purpose. The reason I have to lay that foundation is to answer your question is that what a manager begins to do differently is he spends more time worrying about the context field of energy than he does the activity. Let me give you an example. I was talking with a client about a month ago, and he had just set out a promotional letter announcing the promotion of a new vice president. And in the letter, he talked about everything the individual did, all of his accomplishments, all of his achievements, and how well he was as a salesperson, the accounts he closed, and the results he produced. And I wrote back to the CEO, and actually Chief Operating Officer, and I said, you know, this is really a wonderful announcement, but it talks about everything in the activity field. And I know you actually promoted this guy for a whole other set of reasons. His ability to inspire and motivate people, his ability to work collaboratively with other departments and gain their support for his activities and to support them in their activities. These are skill sets that you use to select, but yet all you talked about was what he accomplished and what he did. And I said, by doing that, you set a tone in the organization. That's what's important, is what you accomplished and what you did, not why you did it or how you did it with others. When he wrote out the next letter, he promoted another vice president. They've been going through reorganization, and they've been growing quite rapidly. He set a whole different tone. He talked about how the person was skilled in inspiring and motivating people, how the person was able to build teams and had great relationships with customers. So he talked about the other fields of energy. And what's important about that, Will, is activity flows out of context. Again, go back to the human body. Our actions flow out of our belief systems. And so what changes in the living organization by shifting the focus on establishing the context field or the belief system or the culture of the organization, the activity happens naturally. And so you're not driving an organization based on trying to manipulate, cajole, and quote-unquote incentivize behaviors. You're actually creating a desire for people to behave consistent with what they truly believe and what they feel passionate about. And that then becomes the fundamental shift in the difference between managing a living organization and managing a machine. A machine, all you can do is manipulate.
So in order for a manager to manage in a living organization, would it be safe to say that manager would have to know precisely what the passions of the people they're managing are?
Yes. Now, you say precisely, not necessarily precisely, but what would be important is to ensure that the people feel as engaged and passionate about what I call the soulful purpose of the organization.
So to be engaged means that somehow I believe the things that I'm passionate about, the organization shares, or I share with something about what the organization's passionate about. Our passions are, to some degree, in common.
Yes, and now you can begin to see the power of it, right? If you're passionate about what the organization's passionate about, how much do I really have to manage you? Probably not a lot.
Well, you might have to remind me. You might have to help me keep me from being distracted, and then you might have to help me if I'm not a calculating type who does a lot of measuring. You might have to help me measure and monitor to help me stay on track.
That's about all. But I don't have to motivate you.
No, the motivation is in me.
See, and that's the power. And then all of a sudden, the organization begins to align with a whole bunch of cellular structures and organs, if you will, the people and the departments of the organization, all lined up to achieve the same thing. And in a very complex, dynamic environment, which we all live in, I really want everybody in the organization to be able to make decisions that's on their own, to make decisions consistent with the goals and the direction and the soulful purpose, what this organization wants to create. No different. I have a friend who uses what he calls the bicycle example. And if you think about it, when you're riding a bicycle,
you don't have to go to your brain to figure out what to do if something gets in your way. You just naturally respond to it. And it's called dynamic steering is the term he uses. Well, that's what the way you want your organization to respond. You want your organization to naturally flow around and through obstacles without having to people sitting around waiting for the executive team to decide what to do or how to do it.
Well, let me check this out then. It seems to me that in order to have that, you would have to, number one, recognize that since your organization runs on the passion of the people in the organization, that you'd have to be pretty clear about who was in the organization and what their passions were.
Absolutely.
And there might be some people who are not, you know, whose passions are going to carry them in a different direction.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things I used to do when I managed the organizations at Hewlett Packard, towards the end of my career, what I finally began to learn was I spent a lot less time trying to get somebody to do something they didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And when I began to get people to want to do what needed to be done, so I'd have conversations with people and ask them, what's important to you? What do you want to do? I used to use the phrase, you know, my job as a manager is to define the rules of the game. And I would say, you know, we're playing baseball here. And I get the sense you really want to play rugby.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a really great rugby team around the corner. As a matter of fact, I know the coach. Can I introduce you?
Yeah.
If you want to play rugby, you shouldn't be on this team, and you shouldn't try to get this organization to be a rugby team, because that's not the game we're playing.
Right, yeah. Well, so let's talk a little bit about somebody we lost yesterday. How do you think Steve Jobs used that in building Apple?
Steve, and I didn't know him personally, so I'm looking obviously like many of us from the outside in. But from what I could tell about Steve, and he had a very clear, distinct passion about what technology was meant to do. I often use the phrase, Steve brought technology to the user where most other companies expected the user to come to the technology.
Yeah.
Steve was passionate about making the technology not necessarily the best, most advanced technology, but the best user experience one could have. And I believe he was so passionate about that that you couldn't possibly work in Apple if you didn't hold that same passion.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that he saw the consumer marketplace, or business market, but saw the marketplace for his devices? Do you think he saw them as part of his organization? Because it's certainly, you certainly get this really clear picture of, I'm a Mac. I'm somebody who's doing it. Do you think that he unleashed the passions of those people out there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that's also part of my model where, you know, the three fields, what we do and how we do it, that's activity. Relationship is who we do it with. And context is the why we do it. The important part of the relationship, it's not only the relationships within the organization, it's the relationships that we have with our marketplace, our customers. And Steve and Apple clearly, because he was so big on the user experience, and Starbucks, by the way, also falls into this category, as does Nordstrom, he was so big on user experience that he invited people to become part of his family.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so you have Mac enthusiasts because they truly were part of Steve's family as much as anybody that worked for him.
Well, Mark, think for a moment. He was a very private person. Some of the commentary said he had a couple of friends, Larry Ellison and somebody else. And outside of that, he didn't do a lot of socializing. At the same time, he had this enormous, what you call family, this enormous organization of people I remember, you know, around the homebrew computing 30, 40 years ago, you also had the Mac groups that got together. And, yep. And once you were part of that group, you were always part of that group. And even though he didn't socialize, he didn't run around the country meeting with these groups. He would, you know, the time you'd meet him would be at the product release.
Right.
But somehow he had distilled all of our enthusiasm, all of our passions, and it comes out in that product release. It's amazing how he did that. But that sounds very much like what you're talking about.
Yeah, and you raise the another aspect of what I'm talking about. The reason I call the book and the model the living organization is because to me, it's been my experience. The organization itself becomes alive. It is a being. It is a living entity in and of itself. It's another, I'll use the word human being. And while Steve was a private person, while he didn't have a lot of relationships, the living being called Apple Corporation had a phenomenal set of relationships with people. And so Steve imbued, it's like a father imbuing his son with a certain passion for what life is all about. And then the son grew up and the son took over the relationships and built relationships, even though the father was very quiet and reserved. And that's the way. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. You caused me to think about the whole Apple organization. I mean, the physical, the real company. Extremely private. Look at all the I don't know if you know, but I mean, just I've watched all the energy around trying to guess what's coming and what's the next iteration of the iPad or the iPhone or the iPod or the MacBook. What's going to be in the but it's all private, and it was all surprise about what the new phone was going to be, but tremendous expectations. How I don't think there's any way that someone with a mechanical metaphor could generate that kind of enthusiasm.
Yeah, you can't. And it speaks to what I would call authenticity of the organization. They weren't interested in false or promotion or hype, and yet they generated a lot of hype out of it, didn't they? You look at any human being and those we are attracted to who we consider authentic, they don't go around promoting themselves a lot. They just offer their gifts to the world, right? Yeah. We go, wow, yeah. Right? A Martin Luther King, a John Kennedy, a Mahatma Gandhi, they just did, right? And that's the way Apple is. They don't go around, you know, telling the world how great we are and what's coming and expect this and expect that. They just say, look, we're working on this and, you know, you'll have it. And when we have it, we'll let you know what it is. And out of that created such anticipation because time and time again, when they delivered, it's like Martin Luther King over time became somebody that drew enormous crowds because when he spoke with authenticity. When Apple spoke, they provided something really unique, and they kept meeting the expectations that they set.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, there's a certain sadness that I felt and still feel about the death of Steve Jobs. I mean, even though he was not a personal friend, he was a leader of mine.
Yes.
He somehow tapped into my passion, and I don't know that anybody at Apple can do that anymore.
That's always been the question that's been raising ever since Steve took sick a while ago. Whether anybody can install that. The real question is now, and everybody's going to be looking at it. Did Steve raise a child that can now stand on its own?
Yeah.
Or is the child always dependent on the father? I don't know the answer to that. My sense is because of the very things we talked about, Steve has imbued Apple with a certain soulful purpose, yeah. A certain sense of mission, a certain sense of values, and you know, to the degree they can maintain that and the leadership maintains that and keeps honoring him, is the degree it'll remain the Apple we all know and love. Look, I come out of HP. It pains me to have seen what happened to HP when they brought in Carly and everything that happened since. The HP way, the thing that made HP its soulful purpose, its reason for existing, started to be overlaid by treating it like a machine, you know, plug in compact. Let's, you know, play with the numbers. Let's Mark Hurd's reduction of R&D, which was at the soul of what HP was all about. The organization can be destroyed, sadly enough.
Yeah, but it sounds to me like what happened at HP was it moved from an organization, I mean, a living organism with a soul for purpose, it moved to a machine that was supposed to produce money.
Yep. That's exactly right.
Well, listen, Norman, I know we agreed to talk about 30 minutes here, but do you have time to, after the break, can we spend a little more time together?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to,
Will. All right, so let's take a little break here, and we'll hear from our friends over at Sandler, and then we'll be right back.
Sandler has over 250 training centers worldwide. This consistency worldwide also helps in budgets because it lowers the travel and entertainment that it takes in order to fly your sales force around for an ongoing program. If we were flying people in four times over the year, yeah, you touch them four times, which is great. We could touch them in our training centers every single month and then give you the feedback about what they're learning and their progress. And so what happens at the training centers is that we'll teach content, how to close, how to interview, and then we'll also do application where people will say, this is my toughest challenge. How do I handle that? And then we share best practices amongst the Sandler trainers because, of course, we're in 24 countries. We're sharing our best practices, but also customers are sharing their best practices.
There are Sandler sales trainers located around the globe, and that's true here in Southern California. Sandler Training in Southern California is here to help you when you're frustrated for any of these reasons. Just listen to these and tell me if any of these hit home with you. Have you ever been frustrated because your salespeople are not hitting their quotas? Or do you get upset because you're just not getting enough good new leads for your salespeople to follow up? And how about that time you're pulling out your hair because your customers are taking so darn long to make a decision? If you're experiencing any of these symptoms, please give the Sandler folks a call at 949-355-6013. They can help. They've helped lots of people out there, including people who hate to sell, because their whole system is designed to make selling natural. It's not gimmicks. It's not tricks. It's not easy. It's not cheap. It's a solid, proven sales system. Been around for years. And it's now featured in countries all around the globe and in all 50 states here in the United States. So if you're having any concerns, any problems, any pressure, any pain, call the folks at Sandler Sales Training here in Southern California. That's 949-355-6013. Tell them that the Pilgrim on the 405 sent you. You'll sure be glad that you did. And now back to Will Crist and his second half of the interview with Norman Wolf.
So, welcome back. We've been spending the last half hour with Norman Wolf, a wonderful guy who's got some exciting concepts about how to take an organization that so often is treated like a machine that's supposed to produce not only widgets but also money, and to turn that into living organism that's there and runs off of the passions of the people in that organization. Now, Norman, before we took a break, we just began to talk about the turn that Hewlett-Packard took. And before we did that, I wanted to share with you a story that was part of my fascination with Apple and Steve Jobs. Way back in, I don't even remember, the 80s, somewhere in there, maybe the 90s. No, I think it had to be the 80s, the early 80s. Apple IIe was out. And that fascinated me. I mean, somehow he caught my imagination. And when I was in graduate school applying for a creative writing course, now this was, you know, right at the very beginning of computers being on home desks. So my writing professor, famous author, said, "Well, Will, if you're going to be in this class, you're going to have to show me, you know, some short stories." And I said, "Well, how many do you want?" And he said, "Well, I'll need to see at least three of your short stories." Well, between you and me, I hadn't written any short stories. I just wanted to plunge into the deep end of the pool. And so I said, "Well, when do you need them?" And he said, "Well, you know, today's Thursday. The class begins next Wednesday. I'd have to see him on Monday or Tuesday." Well, now, normally at that time, and then even when I was in the class, most people typed up their stories on typewriters, right? And if they made mistakes, they have to go back and redo them.
Right.
Well, I was able, because I had a 2E, to go home, and in those 4 days, including the 3 days of the weekend, I could crank out three short stories.
Right.
And so when I brought them to him, I mean, it was fine. I got into the class, but it was only because somebody like Steve Jobs and Wozniak had figured out what was going to help me do what I wanted to do.
That's the brilliance of Steve. You know, I looked at when the iPhone came out to bring it more forward into today's world. And you can even look at the iPad. But go back to the iPhone. We had a lot of cell phones out there. We have some smartphones. The Palm was an advanced phone. And everybody complained about some aspect of the phone. It was difficult to do this. It was hard to do that. The layout was awkward. It was cumbersome. This, that, and the other thing. Everybody had a complaint. When I watched the iPhone came out, it's almost as if Steve took every complaint about the experience people had with their cell phones and said, "We're going to solve that." You know, there's a story about Steve to talk about what his passion really meant that I quote in the book. It comes out of... I can't remember now whether it was Business Week or Times or one of the magazines that quoted him. And it's a story about how they had worked on the iPhone, and it was like a couple of months from launch date, and he had taken what was supposed to be the final prototype home and played with it on the weekend. And he came back on Monday morning and said, "Guys, this does everything we wanted to do. It meets all the requirements. I just don't love it. And we're going to have to redesign it. We're going to have to go back over every decision we made, every specification. It's going to mean 24/7 for the next few months. We don't want to miss our launch date, but we're not going to put out a product like this." And every single one of them said, "Of course." We jumped in, and we got the iPhone that was a world changer, right? That's the passion Steve has for the user experience. I just don't love it.
You were talking about what the role that the leader has. Look at what Steve did. I mean, he could have made plenty of money by letting that phone, the prototype,
absolutely,
go, right?
Absolutely.
It didn't have to do with money. It had to do with his expectation, "We can do better."
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And to the degree, as a leader, he sets that tone, the whole organization begins to, I call it, vibrate to that frequency, right? A lot of organizations talk about caring about the customer or having an expectation, but they never live those principles.
Mm-hmm.
And the employees know that after a while, right? They have posters on the wall that talk about what their values are, and the employees ignore it because it's not lived. Steve embodied, right? And he raised a family of employees who also embody that because they know. Now, with Steve gone, they're going to honor his memory by continuing that same passion, at least for a while. But how long it continues, I don't know. I remember, you know, when I was with HP, Dave and Bill weren't just names. They were the embodiment of something more meaningful, what we stood for. I left in 1988, so it's what, over 30 years I've been gone, and 25 years, whatever it is. And I can still feel that sense of pride and commitment to what HP stood for as embodied in what was called the HP way back then, and the principles we lived for. I still live them in my life today. I was raised by two wonderful parents who gave me, Dave and Bill, from a working career. Steve did the same thing, and that's the role of the leader. And there's ways to do that. It's, you know, one of the things that I recognize, and a lot of people think, is you can't make a Steve Jobs. I disagree with that. I think anybody could be made into a leader if they can touch into their own sense of passion.
Right.
And then live that authentically and express that to the people. And there's skills to do that. Some people have those skills naturally, but the skills that can be learned, the skill of storytelling, one of the most powerful tools a leader has, not just getting up there and reporting on the numbers and, you know, the transactions we processed, but to imbue that, you know, it's that story of, I just don't love it.
Right. Well, and to me, it's that, a couple of things. One, if I don't love it, then they won't love it.
Right.
And they being the people who are following me.
Right.
And therefore, we can do better. And that to me is that's what I see the manager's role is to keep saying we can do better to meet the expectations, meet the passions of the people who are using our services and products. And now I'm with you. There's an old NLP belief that says if one person in the world can do it, anybody can do it.
I absolutely believe that as well.
And so it's a matter of having, again, clear about where I want to go, what I want to do. And I think Steve was very clear about that. I mean, somehow he wanted people to have this experience. I mean, Toy Story is equal an example, right next to the iPhone. I mean, I watched Toy Story 50 times.
I know.
Right?
I know, absolutely.
And so, you know, he did it. And if others want to do it, they can. Now, I think that's where the role of a leader, of a manager, and a coach comes in, is helping people to be better.
Absolutely. And that raises the other aspect of why I look at an organization as a living being. Look, you know, just like our body is made up of cells, the organization has also got a cellular structure, and it's the people. And if you really want the body to be healthy, you got to have healthy cells, right? Well, you need to have healthy people. And the development of an individual isn't just their functional development. You know, lately, there's been, over the last 20 years, we finally begin to adopt concepts like emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. You know, where there's a new one that's coming out that's been talked about for the last 5-10 years now called spiritual intelligence. And it's really interesting. They map to my three energy fields. Functional capabilities is the activity field, right? How we do what we do. Mm-hmm. Emotional intelligence maps to the relationship field, how we relate to other people. How can we interact with them better? What are our skills around that? And spiritual intelligence is an assessment or a measurement of how well we're tuned in to what's important to us, our values, what drives us. Our motivations. I believe that when it comes to performance reviews, we should be looking at all three skill sets.
Yeah.
Right? Not just how well a person does what he does, but how well does he understand what drives him or her, his passions? How well is his EQ and SQ? And let's develop them as a whole human being, not just as functional components to the machine.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's a powerful statement, because when you begin to look at a manager in a living organism, what they really want that cell to do, or that organ, is they want it to operate at maximum fulfillment for that organism, that cell. It's not a matter of how much are you producing. It's what is it that your intentions are? What are you trying to accomplish here? And how can I help you do that?
Exactly right. I call it maximum flow of energy, to make it somewhat pseudo-physical. Mm-hmm. But it is just a flow of energy through the organization. And if I got everybody contributing the maximum flow of energy with the least amount of friction, the organization's going to be highly effective at what it does, especially if they're all aligned to creating the same passionate results. That's why we have to shift paradigms.
Well, and you can really see the difference between an organization that's using the kind of principles that you're talking about, and an organization that is simply looking at its products as an organization, a machine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and if you look at the contrast, so in my book I have a little table that contrasts the living organization from a machine. A machine produces. A living organization creates.
Mm-hmm.
A machine does what it's told. A living organization learns and adopts. A machine, its only purpose is to do. A living organization's purpose is to serve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's a perfect example again of Apple and Steve Jobs. He looks at himself as serving a community of people who want a specific experience.
Yeah.
Starbucks is the same way. Nordstrom's is the same way. Whole Foods is the same way. Trader Joe's. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Exactly. Trader Joe's is absolutely. Now, this might be a little controversial. So,
please, I love that.
All right. Do you think that's part of what's going on Wall Street right now with the people? Are they questioning? Has Wall Street lost its soulful purpose of service?
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up and gave me the opportunity to speak about that as well. I believe what's happening in our society as a whole, and as a matter of fact, I'll say the world as a whole, is over the last 20 years, we've shifted the focus on the metric that we use to define success as the goal of success. The drive for money as the end goal, as opposed to serving customers, serving society. Let's take a look at Wall Street. There was a time, if you look at what the financial markets are supposed to and used to do, it was a resource to companies and individuals that allowed them to better fulfill their mission and their purpose to serve society in some way, right?
Provided capital, right?
Provide the capital I need to grow and expand, mm-hmm. right? If I grew and expanded, then the investor would get a good return on that capital. Not because I made more money, but because I made more money out of creating more value, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Over the last 20 years, since the 80s, or it's almost 30 years now, we began to shift focus on the creating value to creating money. And a whole branch of very talented people came up we call financial engineers. So let me look at it from a systems engineering point of view. What we have is a system, whether it be like a PC board or a car driving down the freeway, and we're going along, and I notice that the speedometer, which measures how fast I'm going down the freeway, is too high. It's reading 100, but I don't like that. So what I do is I take out my screwdriver and I adjust the speedometer. Now I haven't changed the actual operation of the system, the car going down the freeway, I've just made the number look right, right? Well, that's what financial engineers have done for the last 30 years. And perfect example of that, Enron. Credit default swaps. Segmenting mortgage securities into such small pieces that nobody can tell who owns what, right? All we've done is obfuscate the metrics to make the metrics meaningless, and the system is running amok. It's running out of control. We're going down the freeway at 100 miles an hour and we crash. And then everybody goes, gee, I don't understand why we crashed. So metaphorically, of course, is the way I'm speaking, but that's what I think has happened. We have put the focus on the metric and done everything we can to make the numbers look good and paid very little attention to the organization and society and the way it's been operating.
Well, and when you think of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and you think of savings and loans, the reason for them even being there was to help people own their homes.
That's right.
I mean, that's why they started as a service organization, and that's why they were separate from being they weren't banks.
That's right.
You know, banks couldn't take that kind of risk. Savings and loan could. Mutual savings could. There
that's
was
right.
a we're here to help people secure their future.
That's
and,
right.
And something changed. From we're here to help homeowners secure their future to we're here to take money from homeowners regardless of whether their future is going to be secure or not. We're here to take that money and run with it.
Yeah, I mean, look, how silly is it of an investor to offer somebody a zero down 2% get into your home mortgage when they know as a banker, as a rational banker, that person's going to default at some point in time because they have no equity in it and they can't even afford to make the payments once that mortgage rate gets readjusted. And yet we went out and promoted it, get into the house, buy a house. And look at the numbers we're putting on our balance sheets. Look at the way we're reporting income on our P&L to the investment community. And everybody's thinking, wow, look how good society's doing.
Right.
We're driving at 65 miles an hour, and look how good we're doing when, in fact, we're going 150 and crashing and burning. And it's
right.
Just a matter of time.
Right? And to pick up on your metaphor, you know, we're not only going 100 miles an hour thinking we're going 65, we're thinking we're getting to New York when, in fact, we're heading toward the ocean, going exactly the opposite direction.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, we talked about HP, and it's the same thing that happened there. Carly Fiorina wanted to just grow the company for growing the company's sake. And she bought Compaq. And I'm not saying that's a good decision or bad decision. I don't want to – but it's the reasoning behind it that was at fault. She didn't do it because it was the right fit. She did it because you can make the numbers look good.
Right.
Most people do acquisitions mostly because of the numbers.
Yeah.
Right? Let's grow revenue. And they have no understanding of integrating. And the biggest problem is integration. Well, I work with clients, and I have one client I've worked with for a number of years, where when they started on an acquisition strategy, I said, think of it more like you're adopting somebody into your family.
Yeah.
Do all the due diligence, but make sure that this is a good fit for the family. For them, they're going to win, and you're going to win. They've done, I don't know, 7-8 acquisitions over the last 5-6 years, and every single one has been a positive acquisition.
Mm, that's a wonderful thing. That really goes against the trend, doesn't it?
It sure does. And it's because they look at it as a relationship, not as a purchase of another machine to be added to the production line to
right.
produce money.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're somebody in that organization in the leadership role has to be maintaining the direction of the company. If they're there to supply the needs, hopes, dreams of their consumers, of their customers. then the question is going to be, will this new acquisition partner help us deepen that relationship, or will it distract us from that?
That's correct. And will the acquisition joining us benefit from it as well? Well,
that's a good one. That's a good one, too. Yeah.
I mean, if I was going to become part of your family, I'd want to make sure that joining your family was as good for me as it was for you.
Yeah.
And I doubt that many people who do acquisitions even think about, is this good for the target company? I don't want to cast everybody in that light. Obviously, there are a lot of very talented and thoughtful CEOs, and not everybody's an Enron or even a Carly Fiorina in HP. But we are caught up in a paradigm, and that's the key message. We've got to start thinking differently. We've got to start thinking of our organizations as living entities, as children that we are raising.
Yeah.
We want to develop them and all of the parts of the family. That this is a family I'm responsible for. And it's got a lot of stakeholders, and they're all integrated and interdependent.
Well, wouldn't that be interesting to look at an annual report? And the annual report, in addition to all the financial reports, in addition to, you know, the top-line revenue and the ultimate bottom-line revenue and what kind of dividend we're paying to our investors, wouldn't it be interesting to have a section on what's the quality of life in the organization?
Absolutely.
And then how have we served our customers? What's going on in their organization's life that we are assisting with?
That's right. And how are we being in service to?
Yeah, and then if you want to carry it even further, how have we and our customers contributed to bettering the life of people in society?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in my at the end of the book and in my next book, I'm going to expand on it some more. The role of leadership going forward, to me, really carries four major functions or responsibilities. And they are, you got to set the context for the organization. That's the soulful purpose, what we're about, what our values are. We got to develop the people of the organization. We've got to build a community. It's not just entering into transactions with people. That's what you're talking about with Steve Jobs. He built a community. And we've got to remember that we're always in service to that community.
Right? Yeah.
And the community are all our stakeholders. So the four things, set the context, develop people, build a community, and be in service. Mm. That, I think, is the future of leadership.
Well, that should, dude, seems to me that should be the structure of an annual report for a company that's going to be thriving in the future.
I think that's actually a brilliant idea.
Yeah, that's the template. Well, listen, this has been wonderful. We should spend more time together, Norman. This is great. I really enjoy. I really enjoy the time that we've spent together. If somebody wanted to talk with you more, or if they wanted to buy your book, tell us a little bit of how they would do that.
Well, the book's up on Amazon. Its official release date will be November 2nd, but they can order it now as a pre-order. So it's Amazon.com, and it's The Living Organization, Transforming Business to Create Extraordinary Results. They can contact me at nwolfe@quantumleaders.com, nwolf@quantumleaders.com, or they are free to call me on my mobile, which is 949-689-2158.
Is that an iPhone?
Actually, it is.
Yeah, all right. Excellent. Listen, Norman, thank you very much for taking your time to be with us, and let's find some time to continue this conversation.
I would love to, Will. Thank you so much for having me, and I appreciate being able to communicate with your audience and to maybe serve them a little bit today.
Great. So there we have it. Wonderful conversation with Norman Wolf, CEO, an advisor to CEOs all throughout Orange County, California, and across the country. Wonderful conversation, in part a memorial to Steve Jobs and the not only the products he produced, but the kind of organization he created and the kind of high vision and expectation that he had for his team and for the rest of us. So there you have it for the Pilgrim on the 405. Remember that 405 goes all the way up through California to Canada. So lots of territory to cover here in conversations in the future. Look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Take care.
You've been listening to the only show that takes you out into the frontiers of what's possible in today's technology. It's The Pilgrim on the 405, right here on octalkradio.net.
And now let's move to the 17th. John Rollins has 123 yards to the hole and needs to stick this shot tight to have a chance for birdie. Looks like he likes it. Should have the distance. Yes, he nailed it to inside 2 feet.
What does it take to perform when the pressure's on? Ask PGA Tour golfer John Rollins, and he'll tell you it takes years of hard work. And it takes ongoing coaching and support from people who are determined to help you excel. The same is true with sales. That's why at Sandler Training, we bring you the reinforcement you need to take on any sales challenge. You won't fail, because we won't let you. Sandler Training, proud supporters of PGA Tour golfer John Rollins and thousands of exceptional sales performers around the world. Finding power in reinforcement.